readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today we're taking off for an exotic literary destination. We're going to explore titles from Southern Africa with a few side trips. I've been fortunate to have visited the region 4 times, and you may remember that the show's executive producer is from South Africa. We'll be previewing a wonderfully diverse group of titles, some old, some new, and no, we're not going to do Cry the Beloved Country. Yes, that is a landmark book, and you probably read it in high school. While it is definitely worth rereading, there is so much more to share. Let's begin our literary safari, which is actually a Swahili word meaning journey.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the #1 position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Dr. Gregory Lee is a professor in Johannesburg, South Africa, at the University of the Witwatersrand. He specializes in industrial psychology, human resources, and research. Greg also consults and works in private industry, and he has traveled and lectured worldwide. When he's not wearing his business school hat, he writes as a hobby and a passion, and has produced a first novel with a second and third on the way. He's won several local prizes for amateur literature, taught creative writing, and hopes to expand his writing into a more professional and sustained career. Welcome, Greg. So great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Elaine. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
I know that our listeners are interested. What are people in South Africa reading today for fun?
Elaine, South African literature today, you'll find what flies off the shelves will be a combination of some very serious material around the post-apartheid South African experience. And of course, we're talking here about apartheid, the days up until the early 90s where there was separation of race and legal rule of a minority white regime over a majority black, and a huge amount of work, literary work being done around that theme of both the apartheid experience and also post-apartheid living, and how do we get a society back together now that apartheid has been dismantled. And the complete opposite end of the spectrum. The most popular books in South Africa are humor books. And by far the most popular bestseller recently has been a humor book called Spud, about a boarding school boy who actually went to the same high school I went to. And that's what people are reading.
Which high school is that?
It's called Michaelhaus. It's a country boarding school set in the beautiful Natal Midlands, rolling hills and red brick and ivy and that sort of thing. It's a gorgeous sort of very much a take on an English boarding school.
Everyone here is reading the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books. Are they popular in South Africa?
Phenomenally so, and of course the movie just came out. People have been raving about them. I personally haven't read it.
Well, I have, and I'm telling you, you should.
I'll get right on that.
And what are you reading right now?
I tend to read quite a few books at one time, Elaine, and try and mix them up. I'm reading a wonderful South African bestseller from the 90s called Frida and Min, which is about two young girls from very different backgrounds who meet. One is a sort of rich white farm girl who comes to the city and stays with a poor mixed race cousin sort of thing. And a huge amount of pathos. And it's exactly the sort of novel I was talking about earlier. I'm reading a couple other things. Actually, an American classic by Don DeLillo, Underworld, I think it's called. A fantastic postmodern put together of some Americana. And I'm reading a historical novel, The Robe, of course, the great Christian novel.
Hmm. Which books do you think Americans should read to get a sense of South Africa today?
South Africa today. Well, Nadine Gordimer and J.M. Coetzee, who I believe you're going to show a bit preview a bit for the listeners, are two very, very great authors. Both of them have won Nobel Prizes. And they both talk very much into that mid-apartheid era. Gordimer's continued with some work now, but I think for someone to get a sense of South Africa as it is right now, some post-apartheid stuff would be a very good read. It would not necessarily mean the same things to somebody who hadn't lived through that era, but Zakes Mda would be a very good, author to read.
Could you spell that, please? Because I'd like the listeners to know really how to get that book.
Zakes Mda is the author. Mda being the author's surname.
In the United States, there are some classic books that everybody reads in high school, like Catcher in the Rye, Hamlet, Great Gatsby. What are the books that high schoolers read in South Africa?
Well, Elaine, I wish I'd been as in touch with high schoolers as I used to be. I had to go and ask some people and do some reading. It actually hasn't changed much, Elaine. South African high schools are still prescribing the classics, the Shakespeares, the Crucibles, the Great Gatsbys, that sort of thing. So a fair smattering of both. Of American literature, British literature, and world and European continental literature. And there's a smattering in there then of South African novels as well, of the type that I've been talking about, especially in high schools, your classic apartheid stories, your classic reconciliation stories.
Now, Greg, I know that you're an author yourself, and can you share what it's like to get a book published in South Africa? What's the process?
Well, then I'm a dilettante author who has written and looking to publish. The South African market is very small, as you can imagine. I mean, we've got the same population probably as a large state in America. We probably, I don't know, the size of California, I imagine. So to get a novel published, unfortunately, you need to be hitting either a very much a bestseller type of market, or you need to be probably selling something that is resonating in a specific cultural niche. Now, Afrikaans literature is astoundingly popular, and it has proliferated extremely well through the last 100 years. So, frankly, if you can learn to write into especially that particular niche, that's probably the best-selling niche. Otherwise, you need to be writing something that's going to be commercially successful. The odd person will be able to write something that isn't in that oeuvre. And I think the odd art novel will make it through. But unfortunately, as with the rest of the world, the publishing world is a struggling world. It's a world dominated by blogs and social networking, taking people away from wanting to buy. So the old publishing model is as under pressure here. So yes, I think it is a question of asking what would be commercially successful or what would hit on a specific niche.
Now, is there a company like iUniverse in South Africa where aspiring writers can do self-publishing?
there are some self-publishing. There's actually quite a lot of publishing houses. I mean, Penguin are probably one of the dominant ones here, and we have some local publishing houses like Himmel and Rousseau and many others. Mostly in the truly born local publishing houses, again, they focus on Afrikaans. There are a couple of self-publishing, but nothing as good as iUniverse, which seems to be a really fantastic service.
Greg, what writing projects are you working on now?
Elaine, one project that I've actually finished, but I'm still working on it, is a project to try to bring a really postmodern paradigm into what we would call post-colonial writing. So an African story, I actually originally started it as a novel that had no location, but was very clearly an ex-British colony. What we find in South Africa, I think, is we're one of the most liberal countries in the world. We've gone from one of the least liberal, which is speaking into crime in South Africa, unfortunately. It's almost something that you don't want to have to write about. South Africa has a large crime rate. And I've been writing a novel on South African suburbanites of multiple races who decide to enter into a vigilante reaction, having been sort of terrorized by crime. And they join together and begin a rather complex sort of vigilante action that has spin-off consequences and barrels fast sort of downhill in many ways. I think it's quite a fun project. It's a very serious project and one that will resonate with too many South Africans, unfortunately.
Let me ask you the working titles for both of those pieces so that when we see them show up on bookshelves here, we'll know that we've heard about them.
That's very kind of you. Excuse me. The first one is called Narrow Street, which is the postmodern piece. The other piece I've tentatively titled it The Vigil, but I don't think it's a very good title.
Wow. Thank you very much, Greg. This is fascinating stuff. To think that we share the same English language, but the writing and reading habits are different and very similar. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure, Elaine.
Bye now.
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Nelson Mandela's favorite African folktales, edited and selected by Mandela himself, feature stories from every region of Africa. They are classic morality tales featuring kings and children, lions and hyenas, gold and magic. Some of the lessons are straightforward, others are more cryptic, but each is set in its own colorful world. The stories, which average about 10 minutes each, are perfect for children and adults. Narrators include famous people like Don Cheadle, Matt Damon, Whoopi Goldberg, Hugh Jackman, Samuel L. Jackson, Scarlett Johansson, Deborah Messing, Alan Rickman, Charlize Theron, and Alfre Woodard, to name a few. There is also a special message from Archbishop Desmond Tutu and original music by South African legends Johnny Clegg and Vusi Malasela. Part of the fun of this title is trying to figure out who's reading. Net proceeds of this title benefit the Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund and Artists for New South Africa, which works in the U.S. and South Africa to combat HIV/AIDS, provide comprehensive assistance to children orphaned by AIDS, advance human rights, and educate and empower at-risk youth. All the individuals and companies involved in this effort have donated their services to allow a maximum amount of proceeds to benefit the charities. Before we start listening, I wanted to let you know there is a relatively new title from Mandela himself entitled Conversations with Myself. It has been called a singular international publishing event, drawing on Mandela's personal archive of never-before-seen materials, journals kept on the run during the anti-apartheid struggle of the early 60s, diaries and draft letters written at Robben Island and other South African prisons during his 27 years of incarceration, notebooks from the post-apartheid transition, private recorded conversations, and speeches and correspondence written during his presidency. But from the reviews I've been seeing, perhaps this is a title you should read and not opt for the audio recording. Many feel that the narrator, John Canny, is a bit difficult to understand. Now, let's listen to Favorite African Folk Tales.
For a few days, he took pleasure in listening to the fiddler. And he even started laughing and cracking jokes again. But it was not long before he tired of the fiddler and had the unlucky fellow's head chopped off. Then he called for Joseph, his harp player, but it was not long before the music of the harp was just a scratching in his ears, and he had the harpist's head chopped off too. Many more men came to entertain the Sultan and cheer him up, but each time he was content only for a short while. Then he would become restless and angry and call for his soldiers to drag them away and have them beheaded. The situation grew so bad that everyone in the city sat and trembled. Each wondered if he would be the next to be called to the Sultan's palace, only to die by the sword a few days later. Soon, everyone fled. The storytellers, the musicians, the dancers, the jugglers, everyone left the city where the powerful Sultan lived. But one morning, Selham, the snake charmer, arrived at the palace and bravely announced that he would like a chance to tame the Sultan. They brought him to the Sultan, and the Sultan looked at him with interest, this man who played his flute with the snakes that slithered out of his sack and wound themselves around his legs and neck. But it was not long before the Sultan was once more bored and irritable. He felt no further inclination to watch the flute player with his snakes. That evening, when Selham picked up his flute and his snakes to leave, the Sultan said, "My friend, I've had enough of your flute playing and your snakes. I will command my servant to cut off your head with the sword."
One of South Africa's most famous writers, Nadine Gordimer, weaves a fascinating tale that some say transport the reader to the South African veld. In The Conservationist, Mering, a rich, powerful, and vital industrialist, has all the privileges and possessions that South Africa has to offer. But his possessions refuse to remain objects. His wife, son, and mistress leave him. His foreman and workers become increasingly indifferent to his stewardship. And even the land rises up as drought, then flood, destroy his farm. Gordimer, winner of the 1991 Nobel Prize in Literature, paints a fascinating portrait of a man both reckless and calculating, a conservationist left only with the possibility of self-preservation. This is a subtle and detailed study of the forces and relationships that seethe in South Africa today. Narrator Nadia May gives you a wonderful taste of the South African audible landscape.
He is making for the compound. It is up beside the special paddock where the calves are kept at night. But the neat enclosure, with oil drums cut in two to make feed troughs, is empty. No one is about. From a line of rooms built of grey breeze blocks, the sound of radio music whines like audible smoke in the clean, fine morning. It's Sunday. A woman appears from behind the lean-tos of wire and tin that obscure or are part of the habitations. When she sees him approach, she stands quite still, one of those figures with the sun in its eyes caught in a photograph. He asks where the chief herdsman is. Without moving, but grimacing as if she strains to hear, she makes an assenting noise and then answers. He repeats what she has said, to be sure, and she repeats the assenting noise, long and reassuring, like the grunting sigh of a satisfied sleeper. Her gaze steers his back in the direction she has indicated. He is crossing a lucerne field. The last late cutting of autumn must have been made some time that week, although the shriveled scraps that remain, dirt rolls rubbed between finger and thumb or bits of bust balloon, have lost their clover shapes and faded to grey-green. Underfoot they give out now and then a sweetish whiff of summer, breath from the mouth of a cow, or the mouth of a warm, sleepy woman turned to in the morning. Involuntarily he draws it deep into his lungs, and it disappears into a keener pleasure, the dry, cool, and perfect air of a high-felt autumn, which, shut up in the car that carried with it the shallow breath of the city, he has not yet taken. Not this morning. Not for a week. As the air plunges in him, his gaze widens and sweeps. Down along the river the willows have gone blonde, not yet at their palest, combed out into bare strands, but still lightly spattered and delicately streaked with yellowed leaves. Around them is a slight smudgy ambience, a mauvish, smoky blend between their outline and the bright air. A whole clutch of guinea fowl eggs. 11. Soon there will be nothing left. In the country, the continent, the oceans, the sky. Suddenly he sees the figure of the black man, Jacobus, making for him. He must have come out of the mealies on the other side of the road beyond the lucerne, and is lunging across the field with the particular stiff-hipped hobble of a man who would be running if he were younger. But it's he who's looking for Jacobus. There's a mistake somewhere. How could the man know already that he is wanted? Some semaphore from the kraal? The farmer gives himself a little impatient, almost embarrassed snigger, and continues his own progress measuredly, resisting the impulse to flag the man down with a wave of the hand, preparing in his mind what to say about the guinea fowl. Although it is Sunday, Jacobus is wearing the blue overalls supplied him, and although there has been no rain and none can be expected for 5 months, he has on the rubber boots meant for wet weather. He's panting, naturally, but stops as if there were a line drawn there 10 feet away from the farmer, and goes through the formalities of greeting, which include a hand movement as if he had a hat to remove. The farmer approaches unhurriedly. "Jacobus, I was coming to find you. How's everything?" "No, everything, it's all right. One calf is born Friday. But I tried to phone you yesterday night." "Oh, that's from the red cow, eh?" "No, the red cow, she's not ready. It's from that young one, that one's you buy last year from Petersburg." Each is talking fast in the manner of a man who has something he wants to get on to say. There is a moment's pause to avoid collision, but of course the right of way is the farmer's. "Look, Jacobus, I've just been down at the third pasture there. I'm try to phone last night, master." But he has in his mind just exactly how to put it. "The children are taking guinea fowl eggs to play with. They must have found a nest somewhere in the grass or the reeds, and they've taken the eggs. There, by the river. You were there?" The chief herdsman's lips are drawn back from his decayed horse teeth. He looks distressed, reluctant. Yes, he is responsible for the children. Some of them are probably his. In any way, he is responsible for good order among the dependents of the farm workers. And already the farmer has had occasion to complain about the number of dogs they are harbouring, a danger to the game birds. "It's not as if they needed them for food, to eat, no, eh? You've got plenty of fowls. They're just pickin's, and they don't know, but you must tell them. Those eggs are not to play games with. If they find eggs in the felt, they are not to touch them, you understand? Mustn't touch or move them ever."
In 1652, a small group of Dutch farmers landed on the southernmost tip of Africa. Sent by the powerful Dutch East India Company, their mission was simply to grow vegetables and supply ships rounding the Cape. The colonists, however, were convinced by their strict Calvinist faith that they were among God's elect, chosen to rule over the continent. Their saga, bloody, ferocious, and fervent, would culminate 3 centuries later in the establishment of a racist regime in which a white minority would subjugate and victimize millions of blacks. Called apartheid, it was a poisonous system that would only end with the liberation from prison of one of the moral giants of our time, Nelson Mandela. A Rainbow in the Night is Dominique Lapierre's epic account of South Africa's tragic history and the heroic men and women, famous and obscure, white and black, European and African, who brought to life the country that is today known as the Rainbow Nation. The title is narrated by Stefan Rudnicki.
20 centuries earlier, God had sent the emperor Cyrus to release the Jews from captivity in Babylon. Now God sent William of Orange to liberate his captive people in the Dutch provinces. In half the time it took Joshua to seize the Promised Land, the Calvinist William rid his new homeland of its Spanish tyrants, transforming 7 modest provinces into a vibrant republic and one of the world's most modern and powerful states. The prophet Calvin had not been mistaken. God had indeed chosen Little Holland for a privileged destiny. The Batavian people would remember this grace for centuries, until the day when their descendants, condemned to survive amid other people, would commit one of the greatest crimes in history. But in the early 1600s, that fateful moment was still far off. "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven," the psalm reassured the new Dutch Reformed Church congregations. Along the North Sea coast, in the lowlands and towns of Zeeland and Frisia, a golden age was about to dawn, and Amsterdam was its new Jerusalem. In less than 20 years, Holland's capital would become the cultural, artistic, and financial center of Europe. Stimulated by the spiritual and intellectual energy drawn from biblical texts and Calvin's writings, it was open to all cultures, all trades, and all religions. Masterpieces, and what masterpieces, soon evoked this era of vibrant optimism, reflected in the powerful canvases of Rembrandt, Frans Hals, Vermeer, and Bruegel. Life in Dutch society may have continued to bear the stamp of Calvinist Puritanism, but the austere facades of the new patrician dwellings concealed unequaled luxury. The somber clothing seemed to exclude all frivolity, but was belied by the sumptuous silk and satin fabrics worn by the notables of the capital. The small republic's economic prosperity became evident as large companies were established through the issuing of stock. The Dutch East India Company, founded in 1602, secured a monopoly on trade throughout Asia, especially in spices, cloves, cinnamon, and pepper in particular. It was granted the right to open trading posts, deal with local rulers, and install armed forces wherever it wished to establish itself. Soon amassing 150 merchant vessels and some 40 warships, the company became a state within the state that had absolute control over the greatest trading enterprise of its day. Its directors were a council of 17 lords in black satin doublets and white silk collarettes, the Heron 17. Their headquarters was an imposing patrician-style building on the banks of the Cloveniers' Burgwal Canal. In the year 1653 alone, the value of the cargo they traded exceeded the budget for Louis XIV's France. This commercial supremacy allowed Holland to enrich itself through colonial conquest. In 1651, the maps on the walls of the Council of 17's chambers showed no shortage of territory to colonize, whether in Africa, America, or even Asia. A people reminded every Sunday of their God-given exceptional destiny did not question setting off to occupy some other corner of the globe, as they did when they seized the island of Manhattan and founded the city of New Amsterdam. To what new destination and on what mission would the Heron 17's caravels be headed at the end of that year, 1651? An energetic fellow, over 6'2", dressed in a sober black woolen doublet with an embroidered white collar, was about to find out. With a thick shock of brown curls falling onto his shoulders and a determined look under a wide forehead and bushy eyebrows, 33-year-old Jan van Riebeek exemplified the kind of adventurer Frans Hals liked to paint.
Cottier is a preeminent South African novelist, the winner of 2 Booker Prizes and a Nobel Prize. Perhaps you're familiar with him. Set in post-apartheid South Africa, his searing novel, Disgrace, tells the story of David Lurie, a twice-divorced 52-year-old university professor in Cape Town. Lurie believes he has created a comfortable, if somewhat passionate, life for himself. He lives within his financial and emotional means. Though his position at the university has been reduced, he teaches his classes dutifully, and while age has diminished his attractiveness, weekly visits to a prostitute satisfy his sexual needs. He considers himself a happy man. But when Lurie seduces one of his students, he sets in motion a chain of events that will shatter his complacency and leave him utterly disgraced. In the furor of the scandal, jeered at by students, threatened and ridiculed, Lurie is forced to resign and flees Cape Town for his daughter's small holding in the country. This title explores the downfall of one man and portrays the plight of a country caught in the chaotic aftermath of centuries of racial oppression. The book is narrated by Michael Kumsey.
In the field of sex, his temperament, though intense, has never been passionate. Were he to choose a totem, it would be the snake. Intercourse between Soraya and himself must be, he imagines, rather like the copulation of snakes, lengthy, absorbed, but rather abstract, rather dry, even at its hottest. Is Soraya's totem the snake, too? No doubt with other men she becomes another woman, la donna e mobile. Yet at the level of temperament, her affinity with him can surely not be feigned. Though by occupation she is a loose woman, he trusts her within limits. During their sessions he speaks to her with a certain freedom, even on occasion unburdens himself. She knows the facts of his life. She has heard the stories of his 2 marriages, knows about his daughter and his daughter's ups and downs. She knows many of his opinions. Of her life outside Windsor Mansions, Soraya reveals nothing. Soraya is not her real name, that he is sure of. There are signs she has borne a child or children. It may be that she is not a professional at all. She may work for the agency only 1 or 2 afternoons a week, and for the rest live a respectable life in the suburbs, in Rylands or Athlone. That would be unusual for a Muslim, but all things are possible these days. About his own job, he says little, not wanting to bore her. He earns his living at the Cape Technical University, formerly Cape Town University College. Once a professor of modern languages, he has been, since classics and modern languages were closed down as part of the Great Rationalization, adjunct professor of communications. Like all rationalized personnel, he is allowed to offer 1 special field course a year, irrespective of enrollment, because that is good for morale. This year, he is offering a course in the Romantic Poets. For the rest, he teaches Communications 101, Communication Skills, and Communications 201, Advanced Communication Skills. Although he devotes hours of each day to his new discipline, he finds its first premise, as enunciated in the Communications 101 handbook, preposterous. Human society has created language in order that we may communicate our thoughts, feelings, and intentions to each other. His own opinion, which he does not air, is that the origins of speech lie in song, and the origins of song in the need to fill out with sound the overlarge and rather empty human soul. In the course of a career stretching back a quarter of a century, he has published 3 books, none of which has caused a stir, or even a ripple. The first on opera, Boito and the Faust Legend, The Genesis of Mephistopheles. The second on visions of Eros, The Vision of Richard of St. Victor. The third on Wordsworth and history, Wordsworth and the Burden of the Past. In the past few years, he has been playing with the idea of a work on Byron. At first, he thought it would be another book, another critical opus, but all his sallies at writing it have bogged down in tedium. The truth is, he is tired of criticism, tired of prose measured by the yard. What he wants to write is music. Byron in Italy, a meditation on love between the sexes in the form of a chamber opera. Through his mind, while he faces his communications classes, flit phrases, tunes, fragments of song from the unwritten work. He has never been much of a teacher. In this transformed and, to his mind, emasculated institution of learning, he is more out of place than ever. But then so are other of his colleagues from the old days, burdened with upbringings inappropriate to the tasks they are set to perform. Clerks in a post-religious age. Because he has no respect for the material he teaches, he makes no impression on his students. They look through him when he speaks, forget his name. Their indifference galls him more than he will admit. Nevertheless, he fulfills to the letter his obligations toward them, their parents, and the state. Month after month, he sets, collects, reads, and annotates their assignments, correcting lapses in punctuation, spelling, and usage, interrogating weak arguments, appending to each paper a brief, considered critique. He continues to teach because it provides him with a livelihood, also because it teaches him humility, brings it home to him who he is in the world. The irony does not escape him, that the one who comes to teach learns the keenest of lessons, while those who come to learn learn nothing.
Years ago, novelist Paul Theroux first went to Africa as a Peace Corps teacher in the Malawi bush. Now, nearing 60, he returns to travel by train, canoe, bus, and cattle truck from one end of Africa to the other. In Dark Star Safari, he journeys, always overland, from Cairo to Cape Town, and his curiosity and intelligent observations create an unforgettable portrait of the varied land that is Africa today. I picked up this book at the airport in Zanzibar and could not put it down. Publishers Weekly comments, Theroux's encounters with the natives, aid workers, and occasional tourists make for rollicking entertainment, even as they offer a sobering look at the social and political chaos in which much of Africa finds itself. Norman Dietz narrates.
They were hopeful, and so was I. A teacher living near a settlement of mud huts among dusty trees and parched fields. The children shrieked at play. The women, bent double, most with infants slung on their backs, hoed patches of corn and beans, and the men sat in the shade, stupefying themselves on chibuku, the local beer, or kachasu, the local gin. That was taken for the natural order in Africa. Frolicking children, laboring women, idle men. Now and then there was trouble. Someone transfixed by a spear, drunken brawls, political violence, goon squads wearing the ruling party T-shirt and raising hell. But in general, the Africa I knew was sunlit and lovely, a soft green emptiness of low, flat-topped trees and dense bush, bird squawks, giggling kids, red roads, cracked and crusty brown cliffs that looked newly baked, blue remembered hills, striped and spotted animals and ones with yellow fur and fangs, and every hue of human being from pink-faced planters in knee socks and shorts to brown Indians to Africans with black gleaming faces and some people so dark they were purple. The predominant sound of the African bush wasn't the trumpeting of elephants nor the roar of lions, but the coo-cooing of the turtle dove. After I left Africa, there was an eruption of news about things going wrong. Acts of God, acts of tyrants, tribal warfare and plagues, floods and starvation, bad-tempered political commissars and little teenage soldiers who were hacking people. Long sleeves, they teased, cutting off hands. Short sleeves meant lopping the whole arm. 1 million people died, mostly Tutsis, in the Rwanda massacres of 1994. The red African roads remained, but they were now crowded with ragged, bundle-burdened, fleeing refugees. Journalists pursued them, goaded by their editors to feed a public hungering for proof of savagery on earth. Reporters stood near starving Africans in their last shaking fuddle and intoned on the TV news for people gobbling snacks on their sofas and watching in horror. And these people, tight close-up of a death rattle, these are the lucky ones. You always think, who says so? Had something fundamental changed since I was there? I wanted to find out. My plan was to go from Cairo to Cape Town, top to bottom, and to see everything in between. Now African news was as awful as the rumors. The place was said to be desperate, unspeakable, violent, plague-ridden, starving, hopeless, dying on its feet. And these are the lucky ones. I thought, since I had plenty of time and nothing pressing, that I might connect the dots, crossing borders and seeing the hinterland rather than flitting from capital to capital, being greeted by unctuous tour guides. I had no desire to see game parks, though I supposed at some point I would. The word safari in Swahili means journey. It has nothing to do with animals. Someone on safari is just away and unobtainable and out of touch. Out of touch in Africa was where I wanted to be. The wish to disappear sends many travelers away. If you're thoroughly sick of being kept waiting at home or at work, travel is perfect. Let other people wait for a change. Travel is a sort of revenge for having been put on hold, having to leave messages on answering machines, not knowing your party's extension, being kept waiting all your working life. The homebound writer's irritants. Being kept waiting is the human condition.
London's Daily Mirror says no one does adventure quite like Wilbur Smith. Smith, of British ancestry, was born in northern Rhodesia, now Zambia, and was raised on his family's sprawling ranch. He was schooled in South Africa, and when you read one of his novels, you know he gets Southern Africa right. His knowledge of the animals, the veld, the kopjes, which means little hills, the history, and the feel of Africa. In Assegai, set in 1913, ex-soldier turned professional big game hunter Leon Courtney is in British East Africa, guiding rich and powerful men from America and Europe on safaris in the Maasai tribe territories. Among his clients are Teddy Roosevelt and his son Kermit. Being a huge Teddy fan myself, I found Wilbur Smith's detailed and historically accurate characterizations of life on a great safari fascinating. However, the plot centers around another of Leon Courtney's clients, German industrialist Count Otto von Mirbach, who has a company which builds aircraft and vehicles for the Kaiser's burgeoning army. Leon falls passionately in love with Eva, the Count's beautiful and enigmatic mistress. Just prior to the outbreak of World War I, Leon is recruited by his uncle, commander of the British forces in East Africa, to gather information from the Count. He stumbles on a plot against the British involving the disenchanted survivors of the Boer War. When Eva and von Mirbach return to Africa, Leon finds out who and what is really behind the conspiracy. One of my favorite narrators, and a guest on my show, Simon Vance, narrates.
When he rose to take his leave, she walked with him to the front steps and offered her hand in farewell. "Please call again, Lieutenant Courtney, if you are ever in the vicinity. At times, I find loneliness a heavy burden." Her voice was low and mellifluous, and her little hand silky smooth. Leon's duties as the youngest officer in the battalion were many and onerous, so it was almost 2 weeks before he could avail himself of her invitation. Once the tea and sandwiches had been dispatched, she led him into the house to show him her husband's hunting rifles, which she wished to sell. "My husband has left me short of funds, so sadly I am forced to find a buyer for them. I hoped that you, as a military man, might give me some idea of their value." "I would be delighted to assist you in any possible way, Mrs. O'Hearn." "You are so kind. I feel that you are my friend, and that I can trust you completely." He could find no words to answer her. Instead, he gazed abjectly into her large blue eyes, for by this time he was deeply in her thrall. "May I call you Leon?" she asked, and before he could answer, she burst into violent sobs. "Oh, Leon, I am desolate and so lonely," she blurted, and fell into his arms. He held her to his chest. It seemed the only way to comfort her. She was as light as a doll and laid her pretty head on his shoulder, returning his embrace with enthusiasm. Later he tried to recreate exactly what had happened next, but it was all an ecstatic blur. He could not remember how they had reached her room. The bed was a big brass-framed affair, and as they lay together on the feather mattress, the young widow gave him a glimpse of paradise, and altered forever the fulcrum on which Leon's existence turned. Now, these many months later, in the shimmering heat of the Rift Valley, as he led his detachment of 7 Askari, locally recruited tribal troops, in extended order with bayonets fixed, through the lush banana plantation that surrounded the buildings of the district commissioner's headquarters at Niombe, Leon was thinking not so much of his duties as of Verity O'Hearn's bosom. Out on his left flank, Sergeant Manioro clicked his tongue against the roof of his mouth. Leon jerked back from Verity's boudoir to the present and froze at the soft warning. His mind had been wandering, and he had been derelict in his duty. Every nerve in his body came up taut as a fishing line struck by a heavy marlin deep in the blue waters of the Pemba Channel. He lifted his right hand in the command to halt, and the line of Askaris stopped on either side of him. He glanced from the corner of his eye at his sergeant. Manioro was a Marani of the Maasai. A fine member of that tribe, he stood at well over 6 feet, yet he was as slim and graceful as a bullfighter, wearing his khaki uniform and tasseled fez with panache, every inch the African warrior. When he felt Leon's eyes on him, he lifted his chin. Leon followed the gesture and saw the vultures. There were only 2. Turning wingtip to wingtip high above the rooftops of the Boma, the government's district administration station at Niombe. "Shit and corruption," Leon whispered softly. He had not been expecting trouble. The centre of the insurrection was reported 70 miles further west. This government outpost was outside the traditional boundaries of the Nandi tribal grounds. This was Maasai territory. Leon's orders were merely to reinforce the government Boma with his few men against any possibility that the insurrection might boil over the tribal borders. Now it appeared that that had happened. The district commissioner at Niombe was Hugh Turvey. Leon had met him and his wife at the Settlers' Club ball in Nairobi the previous Christmas Eve. He was only 4 or 5 years older than Leon, but he was in sole charge of a territory the size of Scotland. Already he had earned a reputation as a solid man, not one to let his Boma be surprised by a bunch of rebels. But the circling birds were a sinister omen, harbingers of death.
Readers, I know we've been focusing on Southern Africa, but I couldn't resist previewing this title, which is currently at the top of everybody's favorite list. Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese is a sweeping, emotionally riveting first novel. It's an enthralling family saga of Africa and America, doctors and patients, exile and home. Marion and Shiva Stone are twin brothers born of a secret union between a beautiful Indian nun and a brash British surgeon at a mission hospital in Addis Ababa. Orphaned by their mother's death in childbirth and their father's disappearance, bound together by a shared fascination with medicine, the twins come of age as Ethiopia hovers on the brink of revolution. Yet it will be love, not politics, their passion for the same woman, that will tear them apart and force Marion, fresh out of med school, to flee his homeland. He makes his way to America, finding refuge in his work as an intern at an underfunded, overcrowded New York City hospital. When the past catches up to him, Marion must entrust his life to the two men he thought he trusted least in the world, his surgeon father who abandoned him and the brother who betrayed him. This is an unforgettable journey into one man's remarkable life. Sunil Malhotra narrates this epic story about the power, intimacy, and curious beauty of the work of healing others.
After all, it was in the corner of the autoclave room, right next to that stainless steel behemoth, that my mother kept a sanctuary for herself during the 7 years she spent at Missing before our rude arrival. Her one-piece desk and chair, rescued from a defunct mission school and bearing the gouged frustration of many a pupil, faced the wall. her white cardigan, which I am told she often slipped over her shoulders when she was between operations, lay over the back of the chair. On the plaster above the desk, my mother had tacked up a calendar print of Bernini's famous sculpture of St. Teresa of Avila. The figure of St. Teresa lies limp, as if in a faint, her lips parted in ecstasy, her eyes unfocused, lids half-closed. On either side of her, a voyeuristic chorus peers down from the prie-dieu. With a faint smile and a body more muscular than befits his youthful face, a boy angel stands over the saintly, voluptuous sister. The fingertips of his left hand lift the edge of the cloth covering her bosom. In his right hand he holds an arrow as delicately as a violinist holds a bow. Why this picture? Why Saint Teresa, mother? As a little boy of four, I took myself away to this windowless room to study the image. Courage alone could not get me past that heavy door, but my sense that she was there, my obsession to know the nun who was my mother, gave me strength. I sat next to the autoclave, which rumbled and hissed like a waking dragon, as if the hammering of my heart had roused the beast. Gradually, as I sat at my mother's desk, a peace would come over me, a sense of communion with her. I learned later that no one had dared remove her cardigan from where it sat draped on the chair. It was a sacred object. But for a four-year-old, everything is sacred and ordinary. I pulled that cuticura-scented garment around my shoulders. I rimmed the dried-out ink pot with my nail, tracing a path her fingers had taken. Gazing up at the calendar print, just as she must have while sitting there in that windowless room, I was transfixed by that image. Years later, I learned that St. Teresa's recurrent vision of the angel was called the transverberation, which the dictionary said was the soul inflamed by the love of God and the heart pierced by divine love. The metaphors of her faith were also the metaphors of medicine. At 4 years of age, I didn't need words like transverberation to feel reverence for that image. Without photographs of her to go by, I couldn't help but imagine that the woman in the picture was my mother, threatened and about to be ravished by the spear-wielding boy angel. "When are you coming, Mama?" I would ask, my small voice echoing off the cold tile. "When are you coming?" I would whisper my answer, "By God!" That was all I had to go by, Dr. Ghosh's declaration the time I'd first wandered in there and he'd come looking for me and had stared at the picture of St. Teresa over my shoulders. He lifted me in his strong arms and said in that voice of his that was every bit a match for the autoclave, "She is coming, by God!" 46 and 4 years have passed since my birth, and miraculously I have the opportunity to return to that room. I find I am too large for that chair now, and the cardigan sits atop my shoulders like the lace amice of a priest. But chair, cardigan, and calendar print of transverberation are still there. I, Marion Stone, have changed, but little else has. Being in that unaltered room propels a thumbing back through time and memory. The unfading print of Bernini's statue of St. Teresa, now framed and under glass to preserve what my mother tacked up, seems to demand this. I am forced to render some order to the events of my life, to say it began here, and then because of this, that happened, and this is how the end connects to the beginning. And so, here I am.
We're going to sneak over the border from South Africa to Botswana for this next title, one of the newer works by the charming Alexander McCall Smith. Of course, he is famous for the First Lady's Detective Agency series, among others. Now, you might think, how is it that a Scottish law professor has chosen Botswana for one of his most popular series? Let's take a moment to delve into his story. McCall Smith was born in Bulawayo in the former southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. His father worked as a public prosecutor in what was then a British colony. McCall Smith moved to Scotland to study law at the University of Edinburgh. After teaching at Queen's University Belfast, he returned to Southern Africa in 1981 to help co-found and teach law at the University of Botswana. While there, he co-wrote what remains the only book on the country's legal system, The Criminal Law of Botswana. He returned in 1984 to Edinburgh, Scotland, where he lives today with his wife and his daughters. McCall Smith is also an amateur bassoonist and co-founder of The Really Terrible Orchestra. He has helped to found Botswana's first center for opera training, the number one ladies' opera house, for whom he wrote the libretto of their first production, a version of Macbeth set among a troop of baboons in the Okavango Delta. Today, we're going to preview the Double Comfort Safari Club. His body of work also includes the Miss Marple-like Isabel Dalhousie series, children's fables, and so much more. From his years in Botswana, he has drawn the delightful characters of Ma Ramotswe, the generously sized and infinitely wise lady detective, the first in Botswana, her assistant, the plucky Ma Makutsi, and all the gang from Speedy Motors. I was lucky enough to attend a reading by McCall Smith last year. If you ever get the chance to attend one of his readings, don't miss it. He is the most delightful person, and that twinkle in his eye comes through each and every word. In this title, Ma Ramotswe and Ma Makutsi are called to a safari lodge in Botswana's Okavango Delta to carry out a delicate mission on behalf of a former guest. The Okavango makes Ma Ramotswe appreciate once again the beauty of her homeland. It is a paradise of teeming wildlife, majestic grasslands, and sparkling water. However, it is also home to rival safari operators, fearsome crocodiles, and disgruntled hippopotamuses. What's more, Ma Makutsi still does not have a date for her wedding to Futi Ratuputi and is feeling anxious. But with a little patience, just as the wide river will gently make its way around any obstacle, so will everything work out for the best in the end. This title is narrated by Ajoa Ando.
Every car had its good points, too. A comfortable driving seat, perhaps, molded over the years to the shape of the car's owner. Or an engine that started first time without hesitation or complaint, even on the coldest winter morning, when the air above Botswana was dry and crisp and sharp in the lungs. Each car, then, was an individual, and if only he could get his apprentices to grasp that fact, their work might be a little bit more reliable and less prone to require redoing by him. Push, shove, twist. These were no mantras for a good mechanic. Listen, coax, soothe. That should be the motto inscribed above the entrance to every garage. That, or the words which he had once seen printed on the advertisement for a garage in Francistown. Your car is ours. That slogan, persuasive though it might have sounded, had given him pause. It was a little ambiguous, he decided. On the one hand, it might be taken to suggest that the garage was in the business of taking people's cars away from them. An unfortunate choice of words if read that way. On the other, it could mean that the garage staff treated clients' cars with the same care that they treated their own. That, he thought, is what they meant, and it would have been preferable if they had said it. It is always better to say what you mean. It was his wife, Ma Ramotswe, who said that, and he had always assumed that she meant it. No, he mused. There is no such thing as a perfect car, and if every car had its good and bad points, it was the same with people. Just as every person had his or her little ways, habits that niggled or irritated others, annoying mannerisms, vices and failings, moments of selfishness, so too did they have their good points, a winning smile, an infectious sense of humour, the ability to cook a favourite dish just the way you wanted it. That was the way the world was. It was composed of a few almost perfect people, ourselves. Then there were a good many people who generally did their best but were not all that perfect, our friends and colleagues. And finally, there were a few rather nasty ones, our enemies and opponents. Most people fell into that middle group, those who did their best. And the last group was, thankfully, very small, and not much in evidence in places like Botswana, where he was fortunate enough to live. These reflections came to Mr. Gelby Matikoni while he was driving his tow truck down the Lobatse Road. He was on what Marra Motswe described as one of his errands of mercy. In this case, he was setting out to rescue the car of one Ma Constance Mateleke, a senior and highly regarded midwife, and, as it happened, a long-standing friend of Marra Motswe.
This is Elaine Charles. Hamba gashlai, which means goodbye in Zulu. See you next week on The Book Report.
But I ought to lay this burden down, just let it.